now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Good news and bad news, girls. The good news is your dates are here.
What's the bad news?
They're dead.
Ah! See, a United States astro robot becomes a creature of death. Oh.
And Dave.
We have come here to this planet for one purpose only, to acquire breeding stuff to repopulate our planet.
He who breaks the law shall be punished. Back to the House of Pain.
Back to the House of Pain.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-movie podcast from classic cults on the cheese in between. The movies are B, the entertainment is grade A. And I'm your host, Jason Giaconetti, joined by that Mr. Al Giaconetti.
Good morning, Jason. Today we go back again, but it's hard to believe it's 45 years old in probably one of the seminal movies that started a new cult classic. And this one is just Alien.
And we'll get to it right after this. Alien was released May 25th, 1979 in the United States and with a September 6th, 1979 in the UK with a 116-minute running time. The budget here was about $11 million. The box office was almost $185 million, so a pretty good return on investment. Your director, of course, is Ridley Scott. Ridley Scott's known for doing, like, every great movie you've ever seen. He would later go on. At this time, Ridley Scott was not a major director. He was just a young director, up and coming, and then he would go on to do, you know, all the Gladiator and everything else that Ridley Scott eventually wound up doing. Your screenplay is Dan O'Bannon. Now, that name might sound familiar. Dan O'Bannon, of course, from Dead and Buried, which we covered here on the show. And Ronald Shusett is also given story credit with Dan O'Bannon for this as well. That same crew did Dead and Buried. Your producers are Gordon Carroll, David Giler, and Walter Hill. Your music was Jerry Goldsmith. And again, you may not think much of this music. It's very different than other Jerry Goldsmith themes, but it's very, very important. And it should be repeated throughout the series. Parts of his music are repeated in different things, even if he's not your musician the whole time. Your main star here is Tom Skerritt. Now, Tom Skerritt gets top billing because he is the biggest star going into this movie. He would not be the biggest star after later on if you looked at things, but Tom Skerritt is your big star here. Of course, Tom Skerritt, many of you might remember, you know, in movies like MASH, The Dead Zone, he's in Top Gun, you know, and then he, you know, eventually made appearances on like, you know, TV shows like Cheers and Picket Fences and stuff like that. Tom Skerritt was a pretty big actor, late 70s into the early 80s. Yeah. Sigourney Weaver, of course, second build here. Sigourney Weaver would become the breakout star from this movie, literally becoming one of the, you know, she was the archetype for female action heroes, you know, right up there, especially after Aliens. The sequel to this really made her an action hero. But Ripley, her character alone, has been one of the most influential female characters to come out of any science fiction or genre type movie, especially at this time. And then third bill was Veronica Cartwright, which you remember her from the 1978 Invasion of the Body Snatchers, especially the end of the movie. The movie's 46 years old. If you don't know the ending, sorry, I'm going to ruin it. She's the one who screams when she sees Donald Sutherland at the very end. So do you want to throw something about?
Well, yeah, but she started her career as a little girl on shows like Make Room for Daddy.
Leave it to Beaver.
Yeah. And, I don't remember if she had, this was way too long ago, but if she had any speaking parts, but she was a little girl. And that was when in later films, especially the remake, I said, I know that name. And
yeah.
Sure. That's where she's from.
Yep. And then she would later go on being like the Right Stuff and stuff like that. And, was there Harry Dean Stanton, of course. You might remember from movies like Cool Hand Luke or Kelly's Heroes or The Godfather Part II or Escape from New York, you know, going up into even, you know, more recent stuff like he's in The Avengers from 2012. He was in The Green Mile, you know, so Harry Dean Stanton. And then you had John Hurt, which is hard to believe. John Hurt is that far down this list, but he wasn't a major player yet in Hollywood. He eventually went on to become much bigger. You know, considered, he was knighted, by Queen Elizabeth II. He's won BAFTAs for the outstanding contribution to cinema in 2012. He became just a huge, huge star. And you know, David Lynch actually said he was the, simply the greatest actor in the world. It's his list of accomplishments go on and on and on. Very much, you know, he would be, you know, just there's just so many different things that William Hurt eventually would go on to. And it's kind of funny that he's literally, what, fifth billed in this movie.
John Hurt.
Yeah. Yeah. It's John everything. But I'm like, but like it's John Hurt. Like he's fifth billed in here, you know, kind of thing. You know, Sir Ian Holm, that you have two knighted individuals in a movie who are fifth and sixth billed. He would go on. Obviously, he was a major player in the Royal Shakespeare Company. He has a couple BAFTA awards. He also has been nominated for Academy Award. He was also knighted by Queen Elizabeth II in 1998 for his service in drama. And then of course, Yaphat Kotto, who most people probably remember Yaphat Kotto from. It depends on how old you are. So you might remember Yaphat Kotto if you're old, if you're younger, if you ever watched Homicide: Life on the Street, because that's where he's much older, Yaphat Kotto. But some people remember him as Mr. Big in Live and Let Die, the James Bond movie. Mm-hmm. And he's also in Midnight Run, which is a movie you love, the comedy with De Niro and Grodin and all that, I guess. So pretty star-studded cast for a little tiny, you know, kind of like, you know, supposed to be just a sci-fi, you know, genre movie. But people from here eventually went out to become even bigger stars than they were obviously at the time. We're here. So, the movie itself, it won the Academy Award for Best Visual Effects. It won three Saturn Awards, which are Best Science Fiction Film, Best Direction, and Best Supporting Actress for Cartwright. And it won the Hugo Award for Best Dramatic Presentation. It's, in 2002. It was deemed culturally, historically, or aesthetically insignificant by the Library of Congress and was selected for preservation in the National Film Registry. In 2008, AFI named it as the 7th best film in the science fiction genre and the 33rd greatest film of all time by Empire. Obviously, it led to all the different sequels and stuff like that, which we'll talk about more as we go. All right, so let's get started. The commercial space tug, the Nostromo, is returning to Earth with a 7-member crew in stasis. So that's the ship's computer mother detects a transmission from a nearby moon and awakens the crew. Following the company's policy to investigate any systemized transmission indicated intelligent origin, they land on the moon and Dallas, Kane, and Lambert head out to investigate the signal's origin. Okay, so we are now, so this is post Star Wars. So this is a different kind of space. So let's just talk about this for a second, because space in Star Wars is kind of action-y and like things are flying around. This is blue collar space. This is a working, they're basically a tugboat. That's all they are, yeah. Right? This is blue collar, like just guys who are grinding out a job, doing their bit. Let me get paid. Like there's more talk about how much they're going to get paid in the beginning of this movie than I think in any other science fiction movie ever, right?
Yeah.
And it's just funny because it's so different. It's not the action-y, here we go. Oh my God, you're a prince and you're this and you're a knight. And you're like, they're just blue collar. They could be construction workers. They could work on a real tugboat. They could work on an oil rig. Like they're just, you know, real people.
Right. But the special effects of the ships are just as crisp and clear as Star Wars. And the interior, one of the things you notice as the cameras, it's just showing you the interior of the ship, just and with Goldsmith's music behind it. That the visual effect, the visual sighting of those of the interior became almost de rigueur for all future outer space things, because you had to have all the knobs and whistles and the corridors and what have you. Yeah. And so when you see the movie, you say to yourself, that's where it all started. I mean, a lot of previous outer space movies were, okay, you see a rocket ship being carried by a string with the, you know, almost like a Flash Gordon type of stuff. And then Star Wars obviously changed all that. But even going back to the 50s, again, when you talk about Dan O'Bannon being the writer, there was always that mystery that said, didn't we see this movie before? And it was that 1950s, The Terror from Beyond Space, where there's a creature gets on the ship and comes back. This movie, maybe it's got similarities in theme, but is 100% opposite of that.
Well, Dan O'Bannon and even Ridley Scott and all of them, all of them have said from jump, they didn't make bones about it, that It, The Terror from Beyond Space was their inspiration for part of this movie. Now, things change drastically. It's a very different kind of thing. But the idea is that they land on a planet to rescue somebody, and then something that's not supposed to get on the ship gets on the ship. So is that exactly the same? No, because obviously in It, Terror from Beyond Space, when they land, they pick up Marshall Thompson, who's now, all right, it's his last name, right? Yep. Yeah. And everyone else is dead, and they're thinking he shot all of them, but he says, no, there's a creature that's killing them, and in the firefight that someone got shot, like, it's a very different kind of movie. So it's like, so the idea that it's literally a remake is completely different. It's that they took an idea of a creature that's not supposed to be on a ship getting on a ship. And that idea, if once you take from there, then everything kind of goes different. The difference is this, though, and this is one of the big things. Ned just said this. Look at the corridors in Star Wars. They're well lit, clean.
Yeah.
Nothing's grungy. Nothing's dirty. And Star Wars is not supposed to be, you know, like white collar kind of stuff. It's not like the movie like Elysium, where everyone lives on the surface and you go up into the space to live your life, right? And the whole thing is everything there is clean and well lit. This movie is got, it's dark, it's dirty, it's dank for a reason, because you're trying, because it's a working ship. You don't need everything to look pristine because you're working.
Yeah.
I mean, and they're doing dirty work. They're doing, you know, picking things up and moving, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah, the lighting is, it's almost very noirish.
Yeah.
You know, as you go back to the 40s, those noir films were dark and creepy. And that, but again, they've just been sleeping for, I don't know how many years as they're coming back.
Right.
And so there shouldn't be any lights on.
But that's what I'm saying, though. But like, even when you watch like, so, what's the one I can't stand? 2001 A Space Odyssey. Yeah. Right. Like, even everything there, but that's like white collar space. Yeah. That's what they say. That's white collar space. It's all like, wow, look at this, and look at this, and look at this. And this is like, you know, okay, these are the, you know, the working class kind of thing. And that's, and it should look like that, but it gives you that sense. What it also does, besides just the idea of being dark like that, what it does is it sets up literally what this movie actually is an old dark house movie. This is an old dark house in space. That's what this is. And it's not like, you know, Leprechaun in Space, where you just take something, whatever, and put it in space. This is an old dark house movie, and it sets it up from jump, because everything there is kind of dark. Space is a void. I mean, the literally says, in space, no one can hear you scream. That's the tagline to the movie. Like, that's the whole idea. And when, for anybody who ever did the great movie ride back in the day at Disney, at MGM Studios,
yeah,
when you did, now they said Alien, but it's kind of Aliens, because it's not Alien, right? Kind of thing where it's jumping out. You go into there, it changes drastically when you pull into that thing. Like, everything there, besides the steam going off, and it has a smell to it, and like, it just feels grimy and dirty, yeah, and whatever. Well, because it has to hide,
right,
well, the mechanics. Yeah, of
the first one of that ride was Singing in the Rain.
Well, I understand that. What, yeah, I'm saying is, but they have to make it feel, right, so you feel like, wow, okay, this is really, yeah, dark and grimy. Why? But you also need all that machinery, because using H.R. Giger's designs for the Alien, everything there is biomechanical. Everything is like, well, this is a living creature, but it looks like metal. It's not, but it looks like it could. It has pipes and it has bits and pieces, but there's nothing that describes H.R. Giger's work probably more than that, is that it's really that biomechanical blending of the human flesh, or not human flesh, or like flesh with metal, which is something that David Cronenberg explored, even if it wasn't directly to H.R. Giger, later on in some of his movies, with the idea, especially Videodrome. Videodrome explores the idea of like the loss of flesh, but that's a little different kind of, that's to the corruption of flesh.
Yeah. By the way, in the beginning of the movie, when they show you this is a crew of seven, the year is 2037.
Yeah. Yeah. But remember, 2037 seemed like a long way away in 1978, Dad. Yeah. It's like when Thundar debuted in the amazing year of 1997. It's like, wow, we passed it. You know, the Earth, thankfully, no comet ripped the atmosphere off the Earth and cracked the moon in half.
Yeah.
So, okay. But that's what I'm saying. So, yeah. So, anyway, here we are. So, they land on the planet. Dallas, Kane, and Lambert go to investigate. The party discovers there's a form of derelict alien spaceship. Inside, they find the remains of a large alien with a hole in its torso. Okay. So, this, we now know what it is. But at the time, we have no clue. You have no idea what this is. If you've seen Prometheus, you 100% know all these things. And later on, because they never truly explain any of like that part of it. Like in Aliens and Alien Cubed and Alien Resurrection, they kind of get into like some of it, but they don't get into who were the guys bringing the stuff there. Who were the giants? That's what they are. They were giants, yeah, who were bringing the stuff here. And that's what we get to in Prometheus. And you know, and I know some of you will say, I hated Prometheus.
That's
fine. Yeah. Watch director's cut. It's amazing. It literally tells you everything, and it sets up the entire universe and allowing you to then say, oh my God, all the stuff that comes later makes perfect sense, but it's cool. We're at the whole story. The mother later deciphers part of the transmission, which Ripley determines is actually a warning message. Okay. So, you have them go into the planet. They're inside there. The visual effects that they did, that's all done with miniatures. Because they didn't possibly build it as full size. It's all miniature stuff. But the space jockey in the part of the way he's sitting in, right? It looks massive. And they did a really great shot of shooting miniatures and then putting it in and screen screening and stuff. All the effects still work. You watch it now, and the problem is you watch old movies now and TVs ruin them. And it's hard to say that. You're like, how could a TV ruin it? Yeah, the TV kind of shows you all the flaws, right? You know, just not even like, we just were talking about this before the other, I watched my daughter watched the movie, The Tooth Fairy, and I'm watching special effects from 2010. And I'm like, oh my God, can I see through these special effects, which I didn't notice, you know, 14 years ago, but like they look kind of super dated and silly. I'm watching a movie from 45 years ago, and I'm looking at it like, and I know it's a matte painting. I know it's a miniature. I know it's superimposed, but my mind knows that, but my eye can't see it from the picture. And I'm watching it on a 60 something inch television, you know, in high def. So, which is great, which is just, that also though speaks to the filmmaking. That's also Ridley Scott, and that's the cinematographers, and that's how they did it, and that's the special effects that they took advantage of. All right, so Kane discovers a chamber containing hundreds of large eggs. Now, okay, so before you give me, there's clearly a like field or something, and part of me's thinking, why is that there? If I'm getting off this ship, why would there be this thing? Do I really want to step through this thing? Because what does he do when he step through it? It wakes up the eggs.
Yeah.
That's what he's doing. He touches one, and a spider-like creature springs out, penetrating his helmet and attaching itself to his face. Dallas and Lambert carry the unconscious Kane back to the Nostromo. As acting senior officer, Ripley refuses to let them aboard, citing quarantine regulations, but Ash overrides her, deciding to let them inside. Now, Ash is Ian Holmes.
He's the science
officer. He's the science officer, right? Kind of thing, right? So the crew returns to space, and Ash attempts to remove the creature from Kane's face, but stops when he discovers that it has extremely corrosive, acidic blood, could hurt Kane and potentially damage the ship's hull. So that's a new thing. Now you have a creature, which we've never seen anywhere. Because, I mean, some things will have, you know, like, may have, like, really tough skin. You have a dragon, breathes fire. Now you have a creature that we can cut, but its blood is acid. And you're like, okay, how do you deal with that? How do you now deal with, in a metal spaceship, in space, a creature that could chew through your entire spaceship if it starts bleeding, and then everyone dies. So you start weighing out the options. Are they going to just sacrifice Kane, you know, to save the crew? But they brought him back on board. If there is any, parasitic or, you know, anything that they would be in the air or whatever, they've been exposed to it, you know, kind of thing. So you've now already exposed them to that. It's part of, it's kind of the same. It's a similar idea. Carpenter explores that in The Thing, right? Kind of thing. Like, they were like, well, it can look like anybody, but how do we know what it is? And then they're trying to figure out how to, like, find out what it is. And then they realize that the blood here, instead of being acid, is alive, right?
Yeah.
Here, it's acidic.
It's acidic.
If you found out that the thing's blood was acidic, it's a very different way to deal with it compared to everything being alive. And it's one of the things. Had we ever seen at this point, have there been any movies where the blood of the creature becomes something? I'm trying to think. Maybe Night of the Blood Beast, where I think its blood is radioactive, maybe. That might be the only one. I'm trying to think of anywhere where the blood in the actual creature, not the creature. The creature being radioactive, we've seen that.
Yep.
Like, the blood being radioactive in Night of the Blood, I think that's Night of the Blood Beast. I definitely, Beast of 20,000 Fathoms, the whole thing's radioactive.
Right.
Everything's radioactive. But he's radioactive. But the creature's not acidic. You could touch the creature without getting burned,
right?
But its blood is killing. I'm trying to think of, and I don't think we've ever seen
that's probably the only one where the blood is more dangerous to the humans than the creature.
Yeah, I mean, because the thing is that happens in Beast of 20,000 Fathoms, when they shoot it, that's what they say. We can't kill it. Right. We can't so blow it up.
Kill it from inside.
We got to kill it from the inside. That's the whole idea. Which at that time, I don't think that had happened before that. I know in Godzilla, they talk about he's radioactive and he's whatever. I mean, they use the oxygen destroyer on him, which, you know, at the time, brilliant filmmaking kind of thing. Right. But it's like, it's funny because most of the time the creature is the issue. The monster is the problem. Here, it's the blood. It's the what, you know, kind of thing. As much, don't get me wrong, the face hugger is not exactly super friendly here.
Yeah.
But the idea that the blood could literally be worse than the thing that's killed, that's attached to his face, is kind of a different spin on it.
Yeah. Now, at this point, we're about just a little more than 35 minutes into the movie, and up until this point, the movie's been very atmospheric.
Yep.
There's been a lot of banter between the crews and stuff, but there's no hint of a problem. The biggest problem is Parker and Brent. They're bantering back. How much money are we going to
get? It's all about the money. Well, that's what I keep saying.
I'm saying. So this is 35 minutes in, and there's no creature, and yet you know that the title of the movie is Alien.
Yeah, and it shows an egg on the cover.
Right.
It showed, like, so now we've seen the egg, or a form of the egg, right? That kind of thing. Because it doesn't, the egg crack, the egg's gut, like it's cracked different kind of thing, right? So we now understand, well, now it's on his face. Okay, well, is this the creature? Is this what we're looking at? We've seen it, right? And anybody who knew going in that Giger was involved probably had a feeling that this couldn't be the final form. The facehugger is the most fleshy of the aliens and an alien form, right? The egg is still an egg. The facehugger that comes out is the most fleshy version. It's the most, it's the weakest version. It's whatever. We later would see facehuggers do all kinds of things in later movies, but like they still are the one that is probably the least, it's the least armored. It's the, it has no, its tail is sharp and whatever, but it's got claws and a sucker, but it's not huge. It's not going to knock down doors. I mean, it's, you know, kind of thing. It's not that kind of, that kind of alien. Where am I here? Okay. Yeah, it eventually detaches and is found dead. Now that scene's, they're all looking around for it when it falls out of the thing onto Ripley.
Right. That's the first jump scare.
It's a jump scare. And at that point though, you're building to that though. That's like the whole movie's building to it. This is an old dark house movie.
Yeah.
You build and build and build, jump. And an old dark house movie, it wouldn't be an alien. It'd be a guy in a mask, like The Cat and the Canary. That's the kind of movies I'm thinking of, like those kind of movies, those kind of old dark house movies, where it's like a guy in a mask and like he's there, you jump. Oh, okay, right. Kane awakens with some memory loss, but otherwise seems fine. So they decide that during the crew's final meal before returning to stasis, right? And they're all sitting around. Now again, that scene too, they're all sitting around eating. Which just looks like a break room at any mill. They're smoking and stuff like, and you're thinking like, oh, okay, like. Think about the things in this movie that would never be in 2001: A Space Odyssey or Star Wars, right? That stuff doesn't exist. Like, you don't have, you know, even if later movies, like someone's got a pipe or something like that, whatever. No one's smoking a cigarette. No one's drinking a beer. No one's doing the blue collar. Why? Because, and I think Ridley Scott made sure he put those things on purpose.
Yeah.
He wanted every single person in that audience to somehow connect to them. Whether you worked a blue collar or white collar job, or you were a teenager or whatever, you knew somebody who smoked cigarettes or had a beer, who worked their ass off, you know, whatever. Kind of, you know, you want to identify with those people. So he's helping you identify with each and every one of them. Even, you know, at the table, Ash is laughing and he doesn't, and Ian Holmes doesn't seem to want to do anything kind of thing, right? He's a science officer. And even Ripley, who's kind of has to be, you know, she has to be a jerk because she's second in command, but they're all having a good time. I think what you get from that is there's another dynamic involved also. And I don't know how much of that's, people may not see it now because we just kind of assume, but in 1978, that literally Ripley is second in charge is a big deal. That you have a female who's second in charge. Like she's the second in charge of this thing. So it's Dallas and then Ripley. And that's rare in these kind of things. You say, well, Jay, I can cite, you know, here, this movie's here and there. Right. You find the examples that prove the rule. Most of the time, what are the women's roles in science fiction movies? Sometimes they're scientists. Yeah, sometimes they're the assistant.
Might be the medical.
Right. They're the medical. Right. They're the nurse. Right. Yeah, It's the Terror of Beyond Space. The got people in charge are men. And then she's the doctor or whatever right, kind of thing. Right. Which they can do. And The Thing from Another World, right? She basically serving coffee the whole movie. She serves coffee the whole movie.
Well, she was the secretary.
Right, but there's all just men working there. Nowadays, they'd have to make sure we get a woman in this role, in this way, because that's how thinking has changed.
Yeah.
But up to the, even in this point in the 70s, you did not have a lot of women in leadership roles in a situation which would not normally have them. They're the school teachers. They're the nurses. They're the assistant kind of things, right? But even in, like, you start going through, they can be scientists, but they're never the lead scientist, right? That's why a movie like in the Giant Claw, which, you know, special effects aside, she's important. Like he's figuring these. She's the mathematician. Like, you can't do this without me. But that's the difference, though. Certain roles, you can go cherry pick those roles out, but they are few and far between. Now they'll become much more prevalent now. But that Ripley is in that role is one of the main reasons why I think Ripley as a character, I mean, Sigourney Weaver is, you know, has taken Ripley to a new level and how she has created the character beyond that too. But that little piece there takes her to a new level going into now the early 80s, when now things were starting to kind of change in how we got our stuff. Anyway, So during the meal, before Stacy's, he suddenly starts choking, convulse. And that's always funny. The food ain't that bad, which comes back again in Aliens, you know, kind of thing. I didn't think the combat was that bad, right? A small alien creature bursts from Kane's chest, killing him and escaping in the ship. Now, this scene, they said, this was one of the most, when this was shown in theater, because no one knew it was coming. He's choking. And they're like, oh, okay, he's choking on something. And all of a sudden, when the first spray of blood comes, everyone in the theater jumps. Everyone jumps. That is the big jump scare. They got that out of the way. And then you notice it jumps and then it stops. Because it needs you to go, come back down. They need you to get up and come back down because you're going to miss the alien.
Yeah.
So they purposely jump you, get your, you know, everything up. So now you're alert. And then, bam, it shoots again. You're like, what the heck? And then the alien shoots out of his chest and you're like, oh. Now, who did not know they were going to do that? Everyone on set. They told no one. Including Veronica Cartwright, who gets sprayed in the eyes. Now, with the scene we see, when she gets sprayed, she does this. We cut away from is she falls over the couch. She literally falls over the couch behind her. She said it was the most, it was horrible. Thank God they didn't leave it in. She said when it sprayed her in the eyes, the blood caught her right in the eyes. That's a real scream. Everything's real. That's the reaction they wanted. I mean, you see, like, your Fat Kodo and Tom Skerritt, they react. Like, what the? Like, because they didn't know what's happening. They're on the table. He's going to be choking. He's going to spit. They're thinking he's going to spit things up. That's what they told him. Well, all of a sudden, bam, and you're what the? Like, as if something was wrong. Yeah. Like, something actually really malfunctioned on the set.
And that whole scene, including the alien now popping up, and then you see the small alien and its mechanics and everything, it's done flawlessly.
Yeah. You can't see the puppet. It's a puppet in his chest, but you can't see when it goes across the table, there's a track. There's literally a bar and a track, and they did such a good job of disguising and shooting it in a way that even 45 years later in 4K on an ultra high def television, that's 60 something. I mean, the TV where I'm watching it on is probably the size of the movie screen that people saw it on if they saw it in a very small theater, right? I'm saying, like, and you can't see it still. People say, well, you know, there's a split second. You can't see it. It goes by so fast. They did it so well and disguised it so well. Plus, you're still in shock. They knew they got you up, and that's what he called. Now, we've talked about that in slasher movies, right? You know, in slasher movies, they timed out the kill. So you had a kill, and then so many minutes later, you had another which was taken directly from, like, Joe Zito knew this, and that's why Maniac's like that, but it's taken right from porn. That's why you have to have a climax in the movie. This is taken from the old scares you had in the old, you know, movies from the 30s and 40s. They scare you. And then they let you come down so things wouldn't happen. But he let you come down a little and then showed you the very important thing. So now you're hyper-focused on the movie. And now you're like, wait a minute, where'd that thing go? What happened? Mm. Now your mind is filling in, is creating questions that you can't answer. Wait, is that the alien? Is that what's that? How big is it going to? Is it going to get grow? Like, you don't know what's going
to
happen.
Well, then the movie reverts back to the atmospheric thing.
Yeah.
Then they're searching for the creature. And one of the telling scenes in this movie is Brent, Harry Dean Stanton, finds the alien's shed.
Yeah, it's
skin,
coming up. Yeah,
well, almost like a snake.
Yeah.
Now, when this thing took off from the table, it was about a foot high.
Yeah, but it was real fast.
Yeah. But when he picks up the skin.
Yeah, that's coming right here. Yeah. So after they eject Kane's body out of the airlock, the crew attempts to locate the creature with tracking devices and try to kill it. Brent follows the crew's pet Jones into the landing leg compartment where, at this point when they're searching, they find the skin, all this stuff. Like, that's the whole thing. Now you're like, wait, this thing's shedding its skin? It's growing.
It's growing.
It has to grow. So now we are no longer in It's a Terror from Beyond Space. We are now in 20 Million Miles to Earth. Because it starts out real small. Oh, okay, we'll put it in a cage. Oh, look, he's grown. And now they know it's growing. Well, what happens when they're on their way, they're driving to Rome or Verona, where they're going, it escapes the cage. Well, he was this big. Now he's this big. Now he's the size of a man. And what happens? Then the army gets, they're like, size of a man? He's huge, right? Like, but that's the whole idea, is it's the, for whatever reason, that now it's growing. And this is growing not because of the atmosphere. That's what 20 million miles to Earth is, right? Kind of thing there. But it's growing because it's now it hyper metabolizes what's there, and it grows itself out of from the lodged, the egg that's lodged in his throat from the face hugger, then burst out because it matured, it hatched from its egg, and now it's growing.
Yeah.
And you don't know how big it's going to get. So you don't know if this thing is going to be the size of a man, the size of a gorilla. If is it going to be huge? Is it going to, like, a thing that's going to, like, you yeah. know, whatever? Because remember, on the planet, there's a giant man with a hole in his chest. You don't know how big these things got to kill that guy. Yeah. Now they can. Now you're putting together, like, oh, the hole in it. Now, for those who remember that, because most people kind of missed the hole in the chest. The hole in the chest is now that hole in the chest. This guy had an alien. And wait, is he going to get big like him? And that's one of the things that they started to explore.
Now, just when Brent finds the this to me was just great cinematography. When he finds the snakeskin, they're still walking through, and there are a lot of chains that are hanging down within the confines of the ship, and they're going back and forth. That when later on, the alien is swinging back and forth, and your eye is remembering the chains, and it turns out it's its tail.
Yeah.
And it's a shadow on the wall. And I look at, when I saw that again, I hadn't seen the movie in probably about 10 years. I said, man, that is a great scene.
So, and then the chain swinging, that kind of thing, it's a little thing. And I know it's been other places, but Clive Barker would use that again in the Hellraiser series.
Yeah.
The chains are swinging. Yeah. And that is what happens is when people see, they're like, okay, that's just it. But it makes motion occur that you associate as, well, the motion's the chains, which then when the Cenobites start stepping out of it, you're like, oh my God. And then the chains do other things in those movies too. Thankfully not in here. But I'm saying is because if they had chains shooting at him in this movie, they just punt, just get out. Does everyone just jump? Right. But that's the whole thing. The idea of having the distortion of motion, the illusion of motion, because there's motion occurring that you can now hide other motion within. There's nothing more that describes alien. The idea here is the idea that it's hiding in plain sight. It hides in plain, like, unlike the Predator, who would be, you know, the next, that's the next iteration of the greatest, like, alien kind of little creature kind of thing. That hides by cloaking. He's hiding himself by bending light. This alien is hiding because there's metal, there's chains, there's movement, there's grime, there's steam. Well, it wants to hide. The alien itself, now, it's technically, it's dark brown. The alien is technically dark brown. It looks black because it's so dark brown. But when if you paint it, you paint it dark, dark brown, and then you go over it with the sheen and whatever, and it gives it that thing. So, but if it was completely just jet black, all jet black, it would stand out. Because jet black is not what because that's pipes that are grimy and dirty.
Mm, yeah.
It looks grimy and dirty. Mm. That's why when you paint an alien, you always paint the alien, you base it, and you paint it what's called alien brown. This is a great color. And you just keep going with that layer. And then you go over that with some transparent blacks and stuff. And all of a sudden, that light, you're like, oh, well, that's what it is. Because it's your eye reads black. Because your eye has to read black because it's trying to fill in the color. But it's like, wait, but it's not black. That's black. That the space behind him is black. But this is kind of off black. And it's not charcoal. What is it? It's grimy, dirty, dark, dark, grungy brown, which is one of the things that makes it, because that's what also gives it more of a creature effect instead of a straight metal effect. This is not like we would later get in Scared to Death and things like that, which, you know, where the alien itself almost looks like he's made of metal, you know, kind of thing. And of course, Brent's following Jones. We got to get Jones. He'll keep setting it off. Here, kitty, kitty, kitty. Literally out of old Dark House movies. They're always looking for the cat. Wait, where's the cat? Why is there a cat? And what happens? Right. The cat has a jump scare.
Right.
And now it's not a black cat. Jonesy's, a tabby, right? But the thing is, in the old Dark House movies, there's always a cat that has a jump scare and whatever. Oh, where'd the cat go? And they do, what's the cat go? And they walk into their death. Well, what did he do? He looks for the cat and he walks into his death.
Yeah.
You know?
And the thing is, they at the appropriate time, the cat knows what's there.
Yeah.
He can... And then they have a full shot of the cat's face.
Yeah.
And in his eyes, you can see movement.
Well, yeah, he hisses. And then that's when Harry Dean Stanton turns. And there's the full-grown alien. And that's when it zooms in. And in the cat's eyes, we see what happens. See, right. But, I mean, we see him start to get attacked. But then we see in the eyes. And you hear screams. And now you're watching movement in the eyes. You can't clearly see it. But it's like, we could have just shown it to you.
Yeah.
He could have just said, yeah, film it. Yeah, get a stunt guy in here, have another stunt guy grab and pull. Would it be as effective? No.
Yeah.
But because you hide that.
And you still hide the alien to some extent.
Yeah, no, you're not seeing that thing. You have to show the alien. You'd have to show more of the alien in that scene. So you see a little bit. You see a tail. Right. You see like little bits. But you're not. So you kind of know what it looked like when it was small, but it went real fast. Wait, now it's not white anymore. Now it looks dark. Now it looks like, how did he not see? Like, oh, it's huge. Yeah. You know, all those little things start playing in. And that's why it works so well. Where are we here? And disappears with the body. The crew determines the alien must be in the air ducts. Dallas enters the air ducts with a flamethrower, intending to force monster into the airlock. So this whole thing. Now we're playing on, you're in a spaceship, so you're already confined. Now we're in the air duct.
Right.
So now you want to take, now here's where we go back to It, the Terror from Beyond Space. What happens? The guy is, when it attacks, he's pinned down. And he's got the acetylene torch. He goes, he keeps coming here. I keep getting a face full of torch. Right. And he can, but that's what happens. They don't go get a gun because you can't shoot a gun you're not shooting that inside the spaceship. First, they don't have guns. Right. That's the whole point. There's no guns on the ship. So they have a flamethrower, though.
But no, he has to make them.
Well, but a flamethrower, yeah, we could, but because you have something that can burn things, you make a flamethrower, but that's something you can get together. Yeah. You're not making a gun. That's where that inspiration comes from. But now he's in the air duct. So it's not, I'm pinned against the wall and I know where I am. I can see it coming at me. Now I'm in an air duct that's completely black.
Right. So
there's every which way but straight, you know, kind of going.
The audience is now that you go from the open scene where they're going to go into the air duct. Now you get into the claustrophobic thing. And everybody is, I mean, if you're sitting there and you get claustrophobic in a tight spot, you start to feel it.
Well, this is exactly
every emotion.
Yeah. So like, it would be, they would do this again. Like, I mean, we would see this again in different movies.
True.
But Neil Marshall did this to like perfection in The Descent. In The Descent, when the women go in, you're like, oh, it's a nice big cave. Excuse me. There's a movie called The Cave where there's lots of nice big caves. There's really cool monsters and that, whatever. Different kind of movie. What happens in The Descent? They start getting in smaller and smaller and smaller pathways. So now I'm not claustrophobic. And like, I have no problem in an MRI machine or whatever. And I'm like, okay, it's getting harder to breathe because it's getting harder for them to breathe. So now Dallas goes from, okay, here I am. Now he's in this tiny, and it's, and you know how big Tom Skerritt is because you've seen him next to other human beings. And now he's cramped in there. So you start to feel, even if you're not claustrophobic, okay, he's really stuck in there. And there's not a lot of place to move. And now you have an alien that just killed a guy. It's the full size of a man. If it's in there, how is he going to do this? Is the fire going to work? That's the other, you're like, wait, what if it doesn't work? What if the fire doesn't bother it? What if, you know, kind of thing. You're in that situation. So he goes into the airlock, trying to force it into the airlock, but is ambushed and seemingly kills him. Lambert implores that they abandon ship and flee to the escape shuttle, but Ripley, now in command, explains it will not support four people, insists they continuing Dallas's plan of flushing out the alien. Okay, so that is the other problem too. There's not enough. This is the old thing, right? You have so many people on a vessel, but you don't have a way to save all the people on the vessel. They have an escape pod, but it won't support four. So why is there an escape pod?
Right?
What are you hoping everyone else dies and you're the last one left? Like, but that's what I'm saying.
You would think that they would.
You would be away.
A full crew.
Yeah, I'm saying it's like, okay, so maybe the escape pod itself can only handle four, but then you have two of them, and you have three of them, whatever it is. Like, if you have a crew of 10 people and you only have an escape pod that can support one, pretty crappy.
It doesn't have to be a creature that's causing you to want to leave. You could hit an asteroid.
Yeah, something, anything could happen. Yeah. So now you have to make a decision about who lives and who dies.
Yeah.
Like that is, but we later learn that the company, right, which is running this, I feel though the company that's here, and no, that's obviously Weyland Industries, right, kind of thing. I feel like the company here might also have been the company that decided that they needed to go down to the bottom of the sea and drill in Deep Star 6 and Leviathan. I'm just saying, I feel like that company, there always is a company, right?
Now, this is after Dallas gets killed, that Lambert, who's Veronica Cartwright, she's now coming unhinged.
Yeah.
And so she's now getting more, more frightened than frightened. And Ripley, the banter that she has with Ash, she starts to have doubts about, you know, his...
So that's, yeah, that's right here. It's coming up.
Yeah, his ulterior motive.
Yeah. Accessing Mother, Ripley, now she's in command. Ripley discovers the company has secretly ordered Ash to return with the alien for study and to consider the crew expendable. Which is what... Now you're like, wait, but like, what if the thing kills Ash, right? So you start thinking about like, wait, how could Ash know what to do? So at this point, all you know is that Ash seems to have his own game plan. Kind of like this is, Leviathan steals a lot from this movie. She confronts Ash, who tries to kill her, but Parker intervenes and clubs Ash, knocking his head loose and revealing that he's an android. And let me tell you, if you, because no one, when you watch this movie the second time, and you know he's an android, you're like, oh, yeah, he's acting like an android the whole time. Nope. You don't know until he knocks his head off. And you're like, what the?
Well, if you watch the movie the second time and you know that he's an android, watch what he drinks. It looks like milk, but it's kind of murky. And so, but he doesn't drink. Whatever.
He's not, I'm saying, but he's, coffee, right.
It's this white liquid that he's drinking.
But you wouldn't have caught that.
No, that's right.
Until you know what to look for.
Oh, no, you're right. It could be powdered milk.
Yeah, right. We're in space. I don't think we have a lot of cows, you know, kind of thing. He knocks his head completely, and on the side, you're like, oh, my God, he's an android. The first time you see it, it's a shock. Now, I can only imagine 1979. People are like, oh, it's a robot? Like that. That's the reaction. Because what are robots so far up to this point? Most of them are not trying to kill you. Most of the robots, the main robots people are thinking are R2-D2 and C-3PO. The robots are good guys. They're okay. They're for us, right? I mean, the stormtroopers are guys in armor. We know that. You know, Darth Vader is a guy we know is in armor, whatever kind of thing, right? And there's some robots like Saturn 9, but I think that is close to the same. But robots usually aren't trying to kill you. We don't have the Terminator yet.
Yeah.
You know, kind of thing.
He isn't Robbie.
Yeah, right. It's not Robbie the robot. Like, robots tend to be whatever. And even in Forbidden Planet, Robbie the robot's not the villain, you know, kind of thing. The guy's crazy, you know, the id's there, but whatever, you know. The survivors reactivate Ash's head, who confirms the company's orders and states that the alien is unkillable and will, while expressing his admiration for it and taunting them about their chance of survival. Ripley shuts him down and Parker incinerates him. All right, the remaining crew decide to self-destruct the Nostromo and escape the shuttle. However, Parker and Lambert are ambushed. Okay, so that's where they're ambushed.
Yeah.
This scene, I mean, it's hard because, you know, now we're starting to see more of the alien. We see the mouth. We see the, like, Yaphet Kotto, you know, he's not a small dude, and this thing is bigger than him. And, you know, I mean, Veronica Cartwright, at this point, you know, I mean, Lambert's just completely lost. Yeah, she's gone. Now on our own. Okay. So, now on her own, Ripley initiates a self-destruct sequence, but finds the alien blocking her path to the shuttle. She returns as her attempts to unsuccessfully abort the self-destruct, flees back to the shuttle with Jones, and narrowly escapes the Nostromo exploding. Now the Nostromo explodes, and now we're in the escape pod.
Yeah, but before we get to that, there are scenes that will have a great meaning in later films. The when she's trying to get to the escape pod, she sees Brent and Dallas cocooned onto
the
wall.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, cocooned on the wall. So that means that that's like a spider. You know, that's tomorrow's lunch.
You don't know what they're doing with them.
They're alive. You know, Dallas is still living. He says, kill me.
Yeah.
Almost like in The Fly.
Or like in Aliens when they wake her up and she literally says, kill me. And they don't. And what the thing pops out of her chest and then they burn her. Right. But that's what I'm saying is there's so many things that this movie does. Little things that don't seem like they mean anything. And later on you get them reappearing
and again even at this point just before you even get to that the Parker and Lambert deaths were especially scary, but even then, you only see the fully erect creature very briefly. You still have not seen the...
All of it. You can't see all
the movement and all that stuff. In future films, I mean,
they don't have to hide it. Once you show it to you, you don't have to hide it.
Yeah.
But it's like Quiet Place, the first one. Yeah. You don't see that thing forever, right? Well, by the time you get to Quiet Place 2, you already know what it looks like.
Yeah.
So now they show that prequel just came out. They literally show it in the trailer.
Yeah, right in the trailer.
Like, okay. Like, I mean, so we went from a movie that doesn't show it at all. Second one, you know, it's a little different. You know, now we can show things. But now in the first, now we go, here's the prequel. Here's the whole thing the whole time. We know what it looks like. And the same thing, it doesn't, the Predator movies are like that too. The Predator is on the poster for Predator 2, for crying out loud. He's literally on the poster for Predator 2. But the poster for Predator,
nope.
It's Schwarzenegger, right? Now, we don't understand why he's in heat vision. We don't understand why he looks certain way he looks, but we just know that's what it is, right? But once you show it, it's leaked. Once it's out there, it's done. But yeah, they hide it really well. Here, you're hidden up to that point.
Yeah, now we're at the point
where... She's just about to get on the shuttle.
Yeah.
And she takes off with Jones, and then the Stromo explodes.
And she was, yeah, and the Stromo, and she's relaxed. But as in all good movies... The movie isn't over until it's over.
Well, but that's the thing is, not all movies used to do this. Yeah. That used to be the end of the movie.
The end credits are going. You killed, right?
Yeah, you got him. You killed the alien. Good job. Right? The other thing is, too, notice, they keep trying to drive it to the airlock to blow it out the door. It's a Terror for Me on Space. They're trying to get it to the airlock to blow it out the door. But that's, again, it's not that uncommon. That would make perfect sense. How else can you get it off the ship? There's no other... You can't just open a window. I mean, it's not Alien Resurrection. You know, we're just going to open a window and get it out. But, like, kind of thing. So, as Ripley prepares for Stacy, she discovers that the alien's aboard, having stowed itself in a narrow compartment. Now, this is where you're looking directly at the alien. You're looking at him. You can't see him, but you're looking at him. And then he moves. You're like, oh, my God. I'm looking at it the whole time. It looks like metal.
Like camouflage.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but it looks like pipes and whatever. Yeah, it looks like the wall, you know. She dons a spacesuit and then she needs to flushes the creature out. It approaches Ripley, but before it can kill her, she opens the airlock door. The alien manages to hang on, but Ripley frees, but fires the grappling hook, pushing it out the door, then fires the engine, blasting it. So at this point, you're like, the door's open. It's got her. She's getting away. She shoots it with the grappling hook. You're like, all right, there it goes. Wait, now it's hooked because now the grappling hook is hooked. Now it's towing along. So you're like, well, what's it doing? What's it doing? Well, now it's grabbing it. So it clearly doesn't need air to breathe because now it's holding on to the friggin' back of the thing in space. So what are you going to do? There's nothing more you can do to this thing. So the only thing you think is like, well, it's in the airlock. If I close the airlock, it's going to still be there. We get to Earth. It's not going to necessarily burn up in the atmosphere. So fire the engine. The worst that happens is it didn't work. So you fire the engine, and of course, now the alien's in there, fires the engine. Well, it's definitely going to burn the line, if nothing else, right? Even if it doesn't burn the alien completely, it'll burn the line. That's at least what you're thinking is, let me free this thing. Let me knock this thing off so it goes away. Fires the engine, blasting it away into deep space. After recording her final log, she places Jones and herself into stasis for her trip back to Earth. Which we know doesn't go super well, because in Aliens, she's way late for what they're supposed to be. But yeah, so this movie, again, sequels were not like the thing. You didn't make a movie to know you're making a sequel, to know you're making, like, I mean, movies get made with like three-picture deals designed around, we're making three of these things, we're making whatever. Yeah. This movie was made, and if it did really well, maybe you get a sequel. Now, the sequel you get, James Cameron's Aliens, again, think about that. You go from Ridley Scott to James Cameron, two of the greatest directors of the time, maybe, definitely of the time, maybe of all time, right? James Cameron's approach to Aliens is, at the same time being true to the original story, is completely different. He made, like, you know, like, I mean, everything now calls itself Aliens, but he basically made, like, you know, like an army coming in, like it's you're fighting at whatever. I mean, you would, this would be stolen everywhere. Like, I mean, literally everyone calls dog soldiers aliens with werewolves, right? I mean, and that's what it is, right? Because it's an army. It's trained Marines. It's right. Trained whatever.
Well, later on you had the Verhoeven's Starship Troopers.
Well, but that's, the book Starship Troopers came out already. That book has been out.
Yeah.
But in Starship Troopers, the book, for anyone who hasn't read it, sorry, I'm going to ruin a book that's like 60 years old. the humans are the Nazis and the aliens are the Americans, and you root for the and then so he did it because he was like, "Ha, I tricked you. You root for the wrong ones." And it's like, "Thanks, dude." But like, yeah, but Starship Troopers is down way down the line.
Way down the line.
Yeah, but that, at that point, now things had changed even more. We had already seen a lot of other, but anytime there's a group of commandos going in somewhere, they call it, you know, aliens with whatever, right? And so what happens is you have, if you're going to send a bunch of commandos in to do something, you have to make sure that if you're going to be compared to aliens, that you have to step up what you're doing. And that's what happened in a sense with Predator. They were like, oh, you're sending a commando troop in? Now, it's a very different movie because Predator, you're fighting now what they're saying. Well, that's cute. You sent a bunch of, and again, you sent a bunch of Marines in to fight a whole world full of aliens. We're sending in to fight the creature that can kill all of them, which is why everyone immediately said, when are we getting aliens fighting predators? Which is what Dark Horse did in comic book form in the early 90s, which, and then eventually we got movies, right? This movie touches so many other films. This movie has been influential in other places. We've talked about some of the things it drew upon, which obviously, you know, is huge. But what winds up happening is, you know, this movie was already, it was obviously R in the US, and in the British Kingdom, it was given an X rating, didn't have R. And then in Australia, given an M. And that used to be like, because again, that meant little kids didn't see these things. This is for adults. Like they made it very clear on the tin. This is for adults. This is not for little kids. This would be a lot for kids in 1979 because there was not some people don't think about this. The availability of movies, even by the mid 80s, was drastically different than the late 1970s, right? I mean, you didn't have you didn't have dozens or hundreds of movies available to you at all times. So you couldn't go rent movies, really. You could, but not nearly as much as you can by the mid 80s to the late 80s.
The rental industry was just really getting started.
Yeah.
The movies that you could see, you still got a newspaper that said, this movie's opening on Friday. And then by the next Friday, it was gone. And then there was another movie.
Yeah.
But there wasn't any 20 screen theaters.
Yeah. Theaters had to be very conscious about what movie. Now, in all fairness, there was not a blockbuster coming out every week back in the day either. So a movie like Aliens would run several weeks.
Yeah. No, remember, that all started with Jaws in 1975. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about a very short window here between one movie and another. 10 years later, by 1985, the summer blockbuster was there. It was.
Oh, you had to. You had to. Yeah. But by then, you had movie theaters that didn't just have two. I mean, some movies had two screens, but some were up to five and six screens. And then you would have a big one, like you go down to like Elmsford, they had like eight screens or whatever. Yeah. Like that was a big thing to have eight screens. So Alien could stay in the movies or things could stay in the movies. But the problem is that you also didn't, nothing was shown on TV. It wasn't like this on. There is no cable really yet. And if there was cable, they're not showing this. They're showing old movies there in public domain they have rights to. That's part of the problem. You couldn't see this movie again. Like it came to the theater. You had to go back to the theater to see it because you weren't buying it for a home. You know, you couldn't buy the VHS or the Betamax or the whatever kind of thing. That was not profit. At $100, $200 for a thing back when it originally came out.
I'm trying to think. When were we able to start buying? You were about 3 or 4 years old.
But movies, even then, you were spending hundreds of dollars on a movie.
If you rented it, it was like $8.99 to rent.
No. Not that. No. But rentals didn't get back in the day, the rentals. The movie store would buy through the movie at $100.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And then they would rent it to you, but you only had it for like a day or 2 days. And you're paying the $2-3, whatever it was, for that. But they would make that money back because then what some realized they could do, they bought a master and then they would dupe that master in the store and they'd have four to rent or whatever. And what wound up happening was companies started realizing that, putting copy guards and everything else, right? But until you got to a place where movies were more accessible to be purchased. Like there was no Suncoast Video. There was no Saturday Matinee. There was no place selling through VHS tapes at $5 and $10. Well, the Blockbuster eventually was just renting.
Yeah.
Blockbuster originally was just only rental, kind of thing, which is the crazy part. You think about like, really? Like, yeah, because that's how you would rent a movie and you didn't watch movies all week. Now the thing is, on a Monday or Tuesday, you're like, oh, I'm bored. I watch a movie, right? You watched the TV, whatever was on, channel 2, 4, 5, 7.
Yeah.
That's what you had, right? So whatever was on. So if it was a comedy or whatever, that's why the TV shows, the sitcoms of the 80s, blew up because people now had more access to television and they watched them. Yeah. And, you know, that's why, you know, you started getting dramas, you started getting whatever. But that became like appointment television. Like, I know people who were like, you know, in the 80s and stuff, when you start looking like, oh man, Cheers is on. I got to watch Cheers. Seinfeld. Like, we watched Seinfeld every week,
yeah.
Right? Even though we could tape it and whatever, like, we still watch Seinfeld because you're going to, oh, it's new. I got to see what the new joke is, right? Whatever. But that was what happened. People didn't even own VCRs. You would rent a VCR and a couple movies and you'd have it for the weekend. And you'd watch all the movies. And that would be like a big thing to do as a family instead of going out on a Saturday night to the movies, which is what the movie industry was super worried about. Like, if they were worried TV was going to kill them. But then the problem was, what winds up killing them is their greed, because you start jacking everything through the roof. And people are like, I can wait. I don't need to see this movie the day it comes out. I can wait. You know, at the time, it used to be a year to see it.
Right.
But that was the thing is, remember like E.T.? E.T. came out and it was never getting released. And then you had bootleg copies that someone shot with a camcorder in a movie theater of E.T. And you're like, this is garbage. But you couldn't see E.T. otherwise.
Well, how many of the movies did we get at shows?
Right.
Right? That were bootleg copies.
Sometimes those. Yeah. Like when I had Saw in my hand literally the day it dropped, that was someone had filmed it that morning, whatever, put it through. But that was different. Right. But that was few and far between. Most of those things were done. That stuff is taken from an old tape, taken from a Japanese, taken from something else. That's taken from a different source material.
Yeah. Well, that's not.
But some of the ones were shot like that, where they used to shoot in the movie theater, that kind of bootlegging things. That became very prevalent when people were like, look, I have a way to watch this at home. I can't afford to keep going to movies at $5 a movie, because now we would kill for $5 a movie.
Yeah.
Right. But at the time, movies were like $1, $2. You know,
yeah, I mean, a lot of the old monster movies, they weren't available even anywhere. So when you'd go to a show, some guy would have, and what was that? I forget who that guy was, but he would have the Terror from Beyond Space. Oh, I remember that. We don't have it.
Yeah. Well, they used to all be on VHS. So you have the VHS there. You buy a VHS. Yeah. I mean, some of you are thinking like, oh, how can you do that? Like you probably, if you were like disgusted by that idea, then you are so young that you don't even understand this conversation.
Yeah.
Because anybody who's of any age, who's old enough to unremember that, is like, oh yeah, because that's what it was. Because you were like, it always felt like you were fighting against that company who's releasing this movie because, hey, put this, I want to see this again, put it on, whatever. And, you know, remember cable TV, HBO and Showtime, well, it wasn't Showtime, HBO, no one had cable. Cable was a new thing in that time.
Yeah, they had to run the wires
right,
to your house.
Right. And once cable started coming into play, then movies and then companies started realizing, oh, wait, I can start licensing these movies out. But even then, HBO, they didn't show Alien. They didn't show whatever. Like, you had to wait forever to see movies.
Yeah.
Nowadays, I mean, it's to the point where a movie drops May 1. By July 1, I got it in my hands digitally. By August 1, I have it in my hands in physical media. And that's sometimes a slow process. There are movies that I literally have, literally have in my hands in a physical hard copy that I'm like, wasn't this just in the movies? And you're like, this was in the movies 8 weeks ago. 8 weeks, 7 weeks, whatever. It's like, why? Because the movie's dropping. They know that they already start making the Blu-ray. The Blu-ray and all that stuff is being made before the movie's even finished. That's the whole idea. Now it's a very different industry, and that's what I think people don't get. You pulled out your Blu-ray to watch this, right?
Yeah.
I watched it on HBO Max. We both watched the director's cut. Okay. If you have Alien, it's not the director. Now, I have Alien, not the director's cut. Watch the director's cut. If you've never seen the director's cut, watch it. The little extras are worth watching.
Yeah, they're not many, but they're...
Yeah, it's worth it. It's not like Aliens where it's a lot.
Yeah.
So, but what winds up happening is you get movies where you need to, you know... And when you rewatch it, the director's cut actually, the little bits add things on. So, so you don't understand when it's like having the availability of these films. And that's what we're saying. So anyway, all right, folks, so that about wraps it up for, right? We're good with this, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to wrap up Alien. Any feedback? Did you see Alien in the theater? Do you have any feedback? Send it to us. We'd love to hear from you. We'll share that here on the podcast. You know, we have, as we're wrapping up, obviously the summer here, we're getting into the fall. We got all kinds of movies coming your way. We're going to be going back for anniversary of certain movies and films and even TV specials. So, folks, like we say here, keep those cards and letters coming and keep watching the skies.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown. An unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world.
Hi, folks. Luke Giaconetti here. I'd like to ask you a few questions. Do you like giant monsters? Or as they're called in Japan, Daikaiju? Monsters like Godzilla, Rodan, Gamera, King Ghidorah, or Mothra? Do you like more obscure monsters, such as Gappa or Yangari? Do you like giant heroes like Ultraman, or super robots like the Shogun Warriors? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then I think you might like my podcast, Earth Destruction Directive. I'm a dedicated fan of all things Daikaiju, and I'd like to share that with all of you. Please check out Earth Destruction Directive at twotruefreaks.com. Earth Destruction Directive, where we turn your Daikaiju dreams into city-smashing reality.
This has been an episode of Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-Movie Podcast. If you'd like to contact me, please email the show at botsbugsbabes@gmail.com. If you'd like to find me online, I'm on Facebook under my name, Jason Giaconetti. I often contribute to the Two True Freaks Facebook group. You can visit my Facebook page, The Art of Horror Collective, and you can search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective. On Instagram, find me under my name, Jason Giaconetti, and search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective, as well as the new hashtag Bots Bugs Babes Podcast. I'm the only one using them. I'm also on Twitter at Jason Giaconetti, and you can visit my webpage at www.theartofhorrorcollective.wordpress.com. All movies, characters, stories, music, etc. are properties of their respective holders. This is a fan work, and any use of any property is purely for review, discussion, entertainment. So don't sue me. I ain't got anything anyway.
There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow!
Will you stop?